Ours was not the only expedition of its kind. At around the same time, Oxford was sending people to Spitsbergen and Arctic Canada and Finnmark and elsewhere in the Arctic, with much the same scientific aims, and other universities and institutions did likewise. There was a great curiosity, particularly among geologists, with what was discoverable in what they called the Great White. What we found out, or what was found out by others in distant laboratories once they had examined the rock samples we brought back, helped to prove a theory which, then still young enough to need the sturdiness of proof, turns out today in its maturity and certainty to have the most profound relevance to Krakatoa and to the key story of this book. The frigid black and white coast of East Greenland may be a very long way from the lushly tropical green islands west of Java, but the two places, in fact, have a good deal in common, geologically. They are not formed from sandstone, or from shale, or from soft layers of fossil-filled chalk. They owe their origins instead to fire and brimstone. Both Greenland and Java are volcanic places, seared and branded into place by the Earth's most elemental processes. And further than that, each place was made and stands where it does on the planet's surface thanks to the workings of a once mysterious, much derided mechanism that was initially uncovered, or at least more than partly confirmed, by those who examined the collections and results and observations that our trifling little expedition and others like it brought back home. Our collecting boxes, and many that we were obliged by the foul weather to leave behind and collect the following summer season, were filled with scores upon scores of carefully drilled and numbered samples of the country rock of East Greenland. And that means volcanic rock. At the latitude where we had been on the island's east coast, Greenland is more or less entirely underlain by basalt, a dark grey, fine-grained variety of volcanic rock that was laid down in layer upon layer during tertiary times 30 million years ago. Basalt is outwardly an unremarkable rock, generally scenically unpromising, except in its columnar variety, when it forms beguiling spectacles like the Giant's Causeway in County Antrim, or Fingal's Cave on Staffa in the Hebrides. On close examination, it's not at all pretty. It couldn't hold a candle to decorative igneous rocks like granite or gabbro, or varieties of the more exotic porphyries, nor would it often compete as building stone with Jurassic limestones or Italian marble. But for the six of us trudging across the snows that summer, charged with this very particular task, the basalts did have one uniquely interesting feature, one that may not have been readily apparent to the casual glance, but which was crucial for what was then a fledgling programme of geophysical detective work. Cooling basalts, it turns out, contain tiny crystals of iron oxide compounds, principally of the cubic spinel mineral magnetite, Fe304, which are highly magnetic. During the molten, plastic phase of the rock's cooling process, these crystals tend to act as miniature compasses, swinging hither and yon in the still viscous mix in an elegant harmony that is extremely susceptible to the lines of magnetic force that radiate between the Earth's north and south poles. Once the cooling has concluded and the magma has passed what is known as the Curie point and has become solid, technically frozen, though the word used here has nothing to do with the freezing of water and snow, which takes place at a much lower temperature, the alignment of the swarms of magnetite compasses suddenly becomes fixed and is set for all time. And each of them, crucially, is then aligned to where the north and south poles were at the time the rocks froze, in this East Greenland case, 30 million years ago. The compasses are thus powerful forensic tools. They tell us where the poles were in relation to the rocks, or the rocks in relation to the poles, a long, long while ago. Our task, which had been set by a small number of curious laboratories around the world, and whose professors some months before had persuaded a variety of grant-giving bodies to give us sufficient money to charter the icebreaker and buy our Nansen sleds and our pemmican and hardtack, and then to set off, was to collect hundreds of samples of these basalts. If and when we got them home, they would be sent off to the researchers, who would measure the strength and the direction of the relict magnetism of the iron oxide particles contained within them. In truth, the strength of the age-old magnetism only claimed their most cursory interest. It was the direction of magnetism that beguiled them most, and in connection with that we were asked to note very carefully indeed, while taking the samples, the way that they were aligned relative to the north and south poles of today. So we spent hours, day and night, bathed in the Arctic summer's continual sunshine, painstakingly drilling basalt samples out of the sheer walls of the local nunataks. We used a portable power drill with a diamond-studded bit that needed to be cooled by dousing it with buckets full of snow, and we used a very accurate sun compass to make sure we always knew where each sample lay relative to the present-day poles. The selected cores, 8 inches long, 2 in diameter, were then indelibly marked with their geological horizon, how high up each had been found among the other layers of rock, and their sun compass orientation, wrapped in plastic and set aside in specially made boxes of strong and waterproof fibreboard. The science that required the presence of all those basalt cores was elegantly simple and, by the standards of these days, somewhat mundane. The interested scientists all wanted to work on the samples to satisfy a suspicion that had been growing during the early 60s. This burgeoning belief, rooted in an unsayable, almost, in some quarters, almost a heretical view of the making of the modern world, held that the magnetic alignments of crystals in rocks laid down in the past might, just might, be substantially different from the alignments of the rocks themselves today. This was something which, if it could be demonstrated, would spawn a profound revolution in contemporary geophysical knowledge and thinking. If it were to be proved, then the unsayable would suddenly become something to preach, and heresy would, overnight, become dogma. And that is just what happened. The rocks we brought back did eventually, though many months later, prove essentially and exactly what everyone wanted them to prove. A comparison of the directions of the Spinel compasses, the science of studying such phenomena had a century before been given the hybrid Latin-Greek name of paleomagnetism, confirmed what this very large number of scientists suspected. There was a very considerable difference between the direction in which the tertiary magnets were pointing and the position of the poles today. All of the millions of magnets were lined up not towards the present poles at all, but towards a point some 15 degrees to the east of it. It was a simple realization, but it had a stunning effect. For it meant one of two things, that either the poles had moved in relation to the rocks, or the rocks had shifted in relation to the poles. Now, the first was initially the more tempting possibility, since it seemed quite simple for the North Pole, which was, after all, an invisible and rather mysterious entity, to have somehow shifted itself around by 15 degrees. But the laboratories who were doing the work on our rocks had an advantage in that they knew that this could not actually be the case. They were already performing paleomagnetic studies on other Arctic rocks of the same age, on samples from Spitsbergen and the Faroes and Norway, and what they found was that the computed polar positions suggested by the Spinels in these rocks varied wildly, so much so that it didn't look so much as that the poles were wandering as that there were scores of North Poles all existing at the same time. So if there was no polar wandering, then the alternative could be the only explanation. It was an explanation that proved a eureka moment, a truly life-changing epiphany for many of those researchers back in the 60s. It was the realization from the record of the rocks that the basalts of East Greenland had moved. Somehow the basalts of East Greenland had drifted westward through 15 longitude degrees or so in the 30 million years since they had been extruded from the earth. In other words, the long-imagined, but until this moment generally discounted phenomenon of continental drift had, and now moreover had provably and incontrovertibly, occurred. During tertiary times, the seafloor beneath the Atlantic Ocean had clearly and provably spread open. Now, from the Greenland basalts, there was powerful evidence to suggest that the theories of continental movement, with the world beginning as one supercontinent Pangaea, that had then broken up and spread itself over the global surface, which Alfred Wegener had advanced so obsessively and which had been so widely dismissed by the scientific establishment during most of the half-century beforehand, had at last been, by this evidence, more or less decisively confirmed. Later in the 1960s, and with a growing amassment of evidence like that from East Greenland now safely in the bag, a great scientific sea change was in the offing. It first came about unexpectedly. It first came about by accident, and in a much more appropriate piece of geography, off the coast of Java, almost within the sight of the island of Krakatoa. And it first came about, as sea changes are wont to do, at sea. There were two initial discoveries. One advanced the evidence of seafloor spreading and the consequent drift of continents from the merely circumstantial into the happily incontrovertible. The other provided to sceptics something that Wegener had never managed to provide, the model for a mechanism to explain how this spreading and drift might work. It was this that first came to light after a series of unrelated experiments that were conducted off the south coast of Java, quite properly for this story, and particularly so since the scientist who performed the work was a Dutchman from Delft Technical University, a man by the name of Felix Venning Meinertz. His intellectual interest was quite unrelated to continental drift. Venning Meinertz was solely concerned with the very accurate measurement at various places on the globe of the Earth's gravity. He was especially concerned with the measurement of gravity in the mysterious world below the very deep oceans. Since gravity is an acceleration, it is extremely difficult to measure it from something, like a ship, that is itself moving. So Venning Meinertz, to do that, had to try out a series of homemade and very specialised measuring devices. Although the wholesale acceptance of continental drift was not to come about for fully 40 years after Wegener's death, Venning Meinertz performed his early work while the unsung pioneer was still alive, between 1923 and 1927. He had taken a crude gravimeter, consisting of a pair of pendulums swinging in opposite directions, and mounted it on gimbals inside the most stable seaborne vessel he could imagine, a submarine. He then had the Dutch Navy, using submarines with the somewhat unimaginative names of Her Majesty K2 and Her Majesty K13, perform a series of shallow dives off Java, and he found to his astonishment that about 190 miles off the southern coasts of both Java and Sumatra, there was a dramatic lowering in the strength of the local gravitational field. This enormous gravity anomaly coincided precisely with the existence of a tremendously deep and long gash in the seafloor, known as the Java Trench. To appreciate the depth of the trench, one can imagine someone moving eastward, driving some seabed crawling machine, if that's not straining credulity too much, 2 miles beneath the surface of the sea, somewhere off Christmas Island. Without warning, the seabed starts to slope downward at a gradient of 10% or more, and it keeps on going down, 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 until at the dark and ice-cold bottom of the trench towards which the slope is heading, the sea is nearly 5 miles, or 24,440 feet, deep. Then, even more abruptly, the bed begins to climb back up again. It dips briefly down once, and then rises one final time, clear up to the continental shelf, the shallows, the fringing reefs, and finally the beaches of South Java itself. Within 200 miles of the shore are some of the deepest parts of the world ocean. And directly above them, Venning Meinertz discovered is some of the lowest and weakest gravity acceleration to be found anywhere. The Dutchman was promptly invited to the United States by a young Princeton scientist named Harry Hess, and together with two other young men who would go on to become rising stars in the new field, Maurice Ewing and Teddy, later to be Sir Edward Bullard, they took off in a boat called the Barracuda to see if the Java anomalies could be found above the submarine trenches known to exist in the Caribbean. They did, spectacularly so. The four men excitedly discussed why this might be, and Harry Hess and Venning Meinertz openly speculated that they might be caused by some mysterious force that was dragging the rocks of the seabed downwards and, as it were, was dragging the gravity down with them. Hess wrote a seminal paper in 1939. Recently, an important new concept concerning the origins of the negative strip of gravity anomalies has been set forward. It is based on model experiments in which, by means of horizontal rotating cylinders, convection currents were set up in a fluid layer beneath the crust and a convection cell was formed. A down buckle in the crust was developed where two opposing currents meet and plunge downwards. So long as the currents are in operation, the down buckle is maintained. The currents would have velocities in nature of 1 to 10 centimetres a year. Perhaps, at last, we had a theoretical mechanism. Perhaps there were currents below the solid surface of the planet, currents which dragged the continents along on top of them, and which then plunged down and dragged the continents down with them. Continents might thus be moving towards or away from one another at between 1/2 inch and 4 inches a year, a rate that miraculously was entirely consonant once someone hurriedly did the arithmetic, with what Wegener had proposed for the breakup of Gondwanaland more than 20 years before. But this was 1939, and the world was being enveloped in a man-made turbulence of a very different kind. Harry Hess and his bold theory would have to wait until the war was over. But when it was over, a wholly new and unexpected piece of evidence for crustal movement having occurred came to light, also at sea, but this time not off Java, but off the northwestern United States. And while the first groundbreaking pre-war study had to do with anomalies in the Earth's gravitational field, this next series of post-war experiments had to do with a study of the Earth's magnetism. More especially, what was known as the remnant magnetism, the old magnetic signatures that we later studied in East Greenland, that might be held in the rocks of the seafloor. The pioneering work on remnant magnetism had been accomplished largely by an ebullient, red-headed Mancunian named Keith Runcorn. He was a lateral thinker of a geophysicist who wondered out loud if perhaps the magnetic field of the Earth somehow varied over time, if it had perhaps varied in its strength or its direction. And if it had varied, then perhaps a record of those variations would be discoverable by examining the remnant magnetism of rocks that were laid down during the time that was being investigated. In the early 1950s, and using a variety of devices, including a sphere made of 37 pounds of pure gold, borrowed from a very sceptical British Royal Mint, Runcorn and his colleagues and associates studied this fossil magnetism in a variety of rocks of a variety of ages across Britain and came to a conclusion which they published in a paper in 1954. The evidence showed that there were indeed significant variations in the magnetism held in rocks of different geological eras, and this could only really be accounted for by one of two happenings. Either the magnetic poles were wandering about relative to the Earth's landmasses, or the Earth's landmasses were wandering about relative to the poles. This latter, if it could be proven to have happened, was continental drift, and to Keith Runcorn it looked a most temptingly plausible explanation. Further compelling evidence to support this notion was soon to come in. If the rocks on other continents showed the same apparent remnant magnetic evidence for a wandering of the poles, then it was likely that, yes, the poles themselves had moved. On the other hand, if the results from continents far away from one another were different, then it would suggest that it was not the poles that had moved, but the continents. And in 1956, that evidence came in, showing to the delight of people like Keith Runcorn and Harry Hess widely different degrees of magnetic variation. The differences could only be accounted for by the continents having drifted apart from one another. The noose was closing. Wegener's theories were being resurrected, and fast. The clincher came quite accidentally in work that began in August 1955 in the cold seas between America's most westerly point, Cape Mendocino in California, and the southern tip of Canada's Queen Charlotte Islands. An English geophysicist named Ron Mason, on sabbatical at Caltech, was vaguely aware of highly classified US government research into underwater magnetism. Classified, it was said, because the US Navy was looking at deep-sea hiding places for its long-range submarines. Over coffee one morning, he asked whether it might be possible for him to join Project Magnet, as it was called, and, without interfering with the government work, to tow a magnetometer behind the project's ship and make his own maps of any magnetic anomalies he might find down on the seafloor. The project director agreed, and that summer Mason arranged for a long, floating, fish-like object, known formally in the kind of language heard in science fiction as an ASQ-3A fluxgate magnetometer, to be towed behind the US Coast Guard ship Pioneer as it searched for seemingly more important things on behalf of the Pentagon. Ron Mason's instruments, up in the Pioneer's operations room, hooked by wire to the magnetometer that he had left trailing behind and below the ship, recorded variations in the strength and direction of the magnetism of the seabed rocks below. The recording paper, unrolling from its drum, and which in due course was to be superimposed on a topographical map of the seafloor and of the Pacific's coastline, indicated the data by way of an intricate trace of lines, with some of the lines showing that the rocks below had certain properties, and others indicating rocks that had properties that were precisely the opposite. As the hundreds of miles of ink traces began to plot out on the screens, Mason could barely believe what he was seeing. At first, the marks on the ever-rolling drum seemed meaningless, no more than a random mess of indecipherable hieroglyphs. Within a few hours, however, the traces, quite inexplicably, began to display an absolutely regular, absolutely consistent pattern. As the ship cut steadily through the water, and as the floating ASQ-3A behind it recorded the magnetic fields in the rocks hundreds of fathoms below, so the traces began to arrange themselves in an unmistakable pattern of parallel and linear stripes, just like those found on the skin of a zebra or a tiger. The stripes became more and more obvious as month by month the little ship worked itself steadily along its recording route. The vessel would scuttle back and forth along its preordained track, the midshipman keeping it at a steady 5 knots for hour after hour as it traced and retraced its passage along the specific sector of the seafloor that Ron Mason had decided to measure. And as it did so, so the zebra stripe pattern from the rocks below steadily built itself up, with the recording paper eventually being covered with long black-and-white patches, which alternated from black to white to black and back to white again in an even more uncannily regular manner. All of the stripes, moreover, were seen not just to be regular, but after just a few passes of the Pioneer, were seen to be arranged in such a way that they all pointed not merely in parallel, but all pointing essentially only to the north and the south, or to be more accurate, all pointing along the long axis of the ocean in which they were found. The ship might go east-west, it might go diagonally, it might reverse its voyage, but no matter. Pass after pass after pass, the magnetism in the rocks below was recorded as a series of stripes arranged in a long north-south trending pattern that made the plot of the seabed look like an acrylic bedsheet from Fredericks of Hollywood, or a herd of standing zebras or tigers, rather more exotic than it deserved to be. And then, in a flash, everyone realised what it was. The stripes on the paper were recording anomalies that recorded the reversals that had occurred from time to time in the polarity of the Earth's magnetic field. This was a curious reality that had been dimly recognised by a Frenchman named Jean Brunez in the early part of the century, then confirmed by a Japanese geophysicist named Motonari Matsuyama in the 1920s. He showed that there had been a field reversal during the late Pleistocene, 10,000 years ago. 30 years later, his work had been fully confirmed. Basalt layers in Iceland showed a series of back-and-forth field reversals in their remnant magnetism. From then on, there was no doubt about it. The Iceland work and elsewhere showed field reversals to be a standard, if stubbornly inexplicable, feature of the Earth's magnetic field, just as can happen in any man-made self-exciting dynamo. Over the last 76 million years, the paleomagneticists soon reckoned, there had been no fewer than 76 such reversals, and they had continued to a measurable degree right back to the early Jurassic, 150 million years ago, except for a long period between 85 and 110 million years ago when, equally inexplicably, there were no reversals at all, during what has since come to be known as the Cretaceous Quiet Zone. And now, here at last, there was evidence in black and white ink of reversals in the rock's magnetic fields, and moreover reversals that, when plotted onto a map, seemed to occur along regular lines, following a pattern that was imprinted indelibly on the seabed of the northeastern Pacific. And as more and more data were recorded and analysed, something even more astonishing was noticed. The peculiar intricacies of the stripe pattern on one side of the ocean were almost identical to intricacies that could be seen in the stripe patterns on the other, and that there was a point or an axis in mid-ocean about which this symmetry seemed to hinge. In an instant, the explanation for that became clear too. The north-south trend of the magnetic stripes suggested that the rocks below were moving outwards, were on each side flowing away from this central point, just like rainwater hitting the ridgepole of a roof, with some water then going down one side of the roof, some the other. And the conclusion to be drawn from this realisation turned out to be the single missing part of a mechanism for continental drift that Alfred Wegener had never been able to imagine, that the mid-oceanic north-south axis was a place where, presumably, logically, but suddenly somehow astonishingly, entire tracts of brand new seabed were somehow being created. The mid-ocean axis was a ridge of making, where the world was welling up from inside itself and spilling out into the floor to be carried out and away and thus make ever more room for the making of more. And as, over millions of years, this brand spanking new submarine real estate was being slowly and steadily made, and as over millions of years it spread off away from the deep sea ridgepole, both to the east and to the west, so the remnant magnetism of its rocks, with the record of the Earth's polarity reversing itself every few tens of thousands of years, remained locked there on the seafloor for all to see. By seeing this, by understanding what it was, scientists were able to claim at long last that they had evidence of seafloor spreading that was incontrovertible. Once radiochemical dating techniques had been perfected, then the timing of the spreading, the timing of the making of the new seabed, the dating of the continental drift could all be fully established too. Now there was a mechanism and a date, and the rest became suddenly almost too obvious. The conclusions began rushing in, filling the intellectual void that had so plagued the science for all the decades since Wegener had died 40 years before. In 1962, armed with the new evidence from the Pioneer and all the other armadas that dragged schools of fish-shaped magnetometers behind them, so Harry Hess decided he would revisit the nagging question that the war had so rudely interrupted. There was now solid new evidence to underpin his notion that convection currents were at work under the Earth's crust, and the continents were indeed being moved about on it like gigantic rafts, colliding and bouncing and plunging down back into the Earth's molten heart in a ceaseless supra-terrestrial dance. One may quibble over the details, he wrote in a paper that year, and which is now a classic, but the general picture on paleomagnetism is sufficiently compelling that is more reasonable to accept than disregard it. Continental drift was most assuredly taking place. There could be no doubt, and indeed since the publication of Harry Hess's paper, there never has been. By curious chance, I came to know, if slightly, both Harry Hess and Keith Runcorn. The encounter with Hess was to provide the more embarrassing memory, at which I blush to this day. It was the early spring of 1966, and I was approaching 22. I had lately, for reasons of Buggins's turn rather than any innate talent, been elected president of the Oxford University Geological Society. In that capacity, and because I had often visited America, and Princeton University as well, as it happened, I had managed to persuade Professor Hess to speak to the final and celebratory society meeting of that Hillary term. Hess was by then a famous figure, and his acceptance of an invitation written by a mere undergraduate was a signal honour for all. Senior academics from most of Oxford's science departments were eagerly gathering to hear the great man speak. It is a tradition of the Society that the event's protagonists, including the guest, wear black tie. Along with my lieutenants, I met Hess. He was clothed as requested, though he called it his tux, and it looked suitably moth-eaten and academic, at Oxford Railway Station. We had decided to give him, and ourselves, we were spending official OUGS funds, a good feed at a well-known riverside inn out in the country, perhaps 10 miles from town. So the five of us, the Society Secretary, Treasurer, Vice President, Hess and me, drove off in my 1935 Morris 8, a venerable car much prized by my friends, but as it turned out, of lamentably timed unreliability. We dined early and very well, beside an immense inglenook fire, in a building composed of ancient thatch and mid-Jurassic corbels, of soup and lamb and a 59 Alox Corton. Our date with the assembled worthies of the university was 8:30 in the museum. We left at 8:10, ample time to get to the venue. Harry Hess had enjoyed the Corton, and we had opened, as I recall, 3 bottles. He was a happy man. The car, however, was less so. It broke down in some flat and nameless swamp, 5 miles equidistant from both inn and Oxford. It was foggy, cold, and dark. We had no telephone nor any way of finding one. We had no option but to walk, taking a path that our treasurer claimed to recognise and which he laughably described as a shortcut. Well-shone black patent shoes are less than suitable for the Oxfordshire mud. We found a pub and made a telephone call, but to no one who had any idea of any meeting nor of any museum. Hess had a couple of whiskies. We arrived back in Oxford at 10 o'clock, muddy, wet, cold, and in the case of Harry Hess, agreeably and most pleasurably drunk. Our audience had remained, not knowing what else to do. The speech was a disaster. Someone tripped over, and much of what was said was incoherent. Maps fell down. The projector fused. Those in the front row glared at those of us they deemed responsible for the supposed slur on this monarch of high academia. I was not asked to convene any further meetings of the Geological Society, but Harry Hess wrote later to say he could not recall a more amusing or satisfying evening in recent years, and he hoped that we'd remain in contact, which we did until he died 3 years later. I had known Keith Runcorn well during my time as a reporter in Newcastle-upon-Tyne, where he was a professor of geophysics. He'd rather taken me under his wing, a local reporter interested in science who might help him publicise his research on deep ocean tides. He had an arrangement with Cable and Wireless to make use of one of their disused Trans-Pacific telegraph cables, and he'd set up monitoring equipment on Fanning Island, in what is now the Republic of Kiribati, to measure the tiny electrical impulses generated in the cable by the deep-water tidal movements in mid-ocean. For readers in the grim and grisly winters of Tyneside, newspaper stories about the blue waters and eternal sunny skies of a South Pacific atoll made a welcome change. I wrote about him often, liked him enormously, and only wished that my paper had the budget to let me go out, as he had often intimated, to spend a season on Fanning, measuring the currents, soaking up the Polynesian way. Once I had left the northeast of England, Keith Runcorn and I lost touch. One might rightly say that we drifted apart. From time to time I'd see his name on various celebratory papers, or conferences called to note this anniversary or that, and all to do with the theories of continental drift, which, along with Hess and a small army of others, he was now world-renowned as an architect. And then, in December 1995, I read that he had been found brutally murdered in a hotel room in San Diego. He'd been on his way to the annual meeting in San Francisco of the American Geophysical Union. He was to give a paper about his new interest, the magnetic fields that were then being measured on the surface of the moon. Part 4. Definition. It turned out to be but a short step from a wholesale acceptance of the mechanics of continental drift to the creation of the entirely new theory that would be christened plate tectonics, that set of abiding planetary principles that today is generally acknowledged to be the first properly global theory to have been adduced and accepted in the history of Earth science. The crucial first mention of the new theory came on the 24th of July 1965 in the British journal Nature, under the authorship of the genial Canadian who is now most generally accepted as the father of plate tectonics. Many hundreds of scientists had already spent thousands of man-years working away with their gravimeters and magnetometers, their polarizing microscopes and their hammers, to create a vague and pointillist image of the emerging new theory. But it was not fully recognized as such until that summer's morning in 1965, when the thick, red-covered, and in those days always infuriatingly tightly rolled magazine, thudded onto their desks in geological laboratories across the world. And then, though scores had been involved, no scores seemed to need settling. There was no contest for this particular moment of glory. It was the bluff, genial, approachable and down-to-earth University of Toronto professor J. Tuzo Wilson, who, by opening his four-page essay with the following declarative paragraph, in essence created an entire new science. "Many geologists," he wrote, "have maintained that movements of the Earth's crust are concentrated in mobile belts, which may take the form of mountains, mid-ocean ridges, or major faults. This article suggests that these features are not isolated, that few come to dead ends, but that they are connected into a continuous network of mobile belts about the Earth which divide the surface into several large, rigid plates." Tuzo Wilson's realization was essentially twofold. The one new discovery announced in this seminal 1965 Nature paper, the other, inextricably linked, and which he had made 2 years beforehand, when the reacceptance of continental drift was well underway, but needed as much hard evidence in support as could be found. The first discovery came when J. Tuzo Wilson looked at the Hawaiian Islands, and after looking and thinking about what he saw, he came up with a piece of evidence which added mightily to all the news about tiger-striped remnant magnetics and basalt conveyor belts on the bed of the ocean. In the tradition of good science, close observation and prescient deduction, with in this case the addition of the basilisk glare of his own geophysical insight, he saw something, something that the ancient Hawaiians themselves had suspected for centuries. The Hawaiian island chain stretches for more than 2,500 miles across 30 degrees of Pacific longitude. Most of the islands one would not think of as Hawaiian: Nihoa, Neka, Tern, Disappearing, Lysan, Lisianski, Kittery and Seal Islands, for example, are almost unknown. Only Midway and Ocean Islands at the northwestern end of the chain are household names, and those mainly because of wars and naval battles. What is currently, but technically wrongly, thought of as the Hawaiian Islands is the 400-mile line of just 9 bodies of rock and palm reaching from the outermost pinnacle of Kaula via the northwesternmost and still privately owned island of Niihau to that great chunk of basalt at the southeast called Hawaii, and which is known by most non-Polynesian visitors as the Big Island. Hawaiian legend has long acknowledged what casual visitors may notice too, that the dusty, half-dead island of Niihau looks much wearier and older than the feisty, bubbling and fiery island of Hawaii. The dank, black Waialiali swamp at the summit of Kauai, the wettest place on earth, the locals say, looks prehistoric. The fresh crags of Diamond Head on Oahu, the diamonds being glittery and new-looking olivine crystals, look young. To ancient Polynesians, who looked closely at the island's soil erosion and vegetation, the difference in age was also self-evident. They incorporated the difference in age into their stories. Pele, the goddess of volcanoes, once lived in Kauai. But then she was attacked by her older sister, Namakawa Kahai, the goddess of the sea, and so she fled southeast to Oahu. Namakawa Kahai attacked again. Pele moved southeast once more to Maui. And then a third time, whereupon Pele moved yet again, this time to the Halemaumau crater of Kilauea, on the summit of Hawaii itself. She had moved 300 miles southeastwards, hopping from island to island as one volcano after another exploded and died behind her. Like many legends, this old yarn has its basis in fact, of course. The sea attacks volcanoes. The waters and the waves erode away the fresh-laid rocks. And this is why Pele herself moved, shifting always to the younger and newer volcanoes as she moved relentlessly away from the older and worn-out islands of the northwest and down towards their more recently created and unspoiled cousins in the southeast. It was in 1963, in the cold of faraway Toronto, that J. Tuzo Wilson first looked at these stories and examined the geological maps and peered at the records of the various eruptions and lava flows on the Hawaiian main chain and came up with an idea. Volcanoes had existed in this area of the world for what seemed a very long period of time, and so it seemed likely that for some reason there was at this particular point in the Earth's mantle a deep and stationary hot spot. Geologists have since elided the phrase to form today's single word, hotspot. The heat from this fiercely hot zone partly melted the rocks of the upper mantle lying above it. The magma created by this melting was lighter than the surrounding solid rock, burst through the remainder of the mantle into and through the crust, and then erupted through the ocean floor to produce either a seamount that would remain always below the surface or an undersea volcano that would grow and grow until it breached the surface of the sea and emerged as an island. That part seems simple and logical, but what Wilson then deduced, both from the Polynesian legends and from his own observation, was that while the hot spot remained static, the upper mantle and crust above had moved, carrying one island at a time away from the hot spot and abruptly stopping the volcanism there. After a while, magma erupted again at a new site that lay in the wake, as it were, of the first moving island, and another fresh island was made altogether. It was rather like moving a baking tray full of batter slowly away from a single intense gas burner, creating a line of ripples and partially cooked batter, the batter cooked at one end of the pan, uncooked at the other, and all the stages in between. Here in the Pacific, on the grand scale, was a 400-mile-long trail of volcanoes in various stages of cooking. The older rocks were in this case at the northwestern end of the trail, the newer rocks at the southeastern. If the radiometric dating confirmed this, then it could be incontrovertibly proven that the mantle and crust along the Hawaiian chain was itself moving northwestward over a hotspot that was now and long had been sighted directly under where the Big Island is today. And the dating of the rocks proved it, precisely. The Kauai basalts were shown to be 5.5 million years old. Those on Hawaii itself were on average less than 0.7 million years old, and in the craters where Pele is now said to be lurking, they were still being created. Millions of tons of hotspot-induced basaltic melt baked afresh every day. The dating clinched the idea. Wilson was shown to be exactly right, and now science could add to the evidence of the Tiger Stripe magnetic anomalies off Seattle this second indication of the undersea geological conveyor belt. The magnetic evidence had been found below the surface. This, from Hawaii, was by contrast all on the surface. Together they presented science with a sort of gigantic rock-hewn tape recorder that showed not only the mid-Pacific movement that had been taking place over the last 5 million years, but also the expansion of the seafloor, with the continents on each side of it that were undeniably and indisputably drifting. The second realization, a true eureka moment of epiphany, came after Wilson started experimenting not with rocks and magnetic traces or radioactive rubidium, but with paper and a set of scissors. The title of his famous Nature paper, A New Class of Faults and Their Bearing on Continental Drift, suggests why he was indulging himself so. John Dewey, who went on from Cambridge to become Professor of Geology at Oxford, and is now on the faculty of the geology department at the University of California, Davis, remembers the moment. It was one early autumn morning in 1964. I was sitting in my room in the Sedgwick Museum in Cambridge when Toronto's Tuzo Wilson, on sabbatical leave, sauntered in, clearly bursting to tell anyone who would listen about his new ideas. He'd discovered that I was the new lecturer in structural geology and said, "Dewey, I've discovered a new class of fault." "Rubbish," I said. "We know about the geology and kinematics of every kind of fault known to mankind." Tuzo grinned and produced a simple, coloured, folded paper version of his now famous ridge-transform-ridge model and proceeded to open and close it with that wonderful smile on his face. I was transfixed, both by the realisation that I was seeing something profoundly new and important and by the fact that I was talking to a very clever and original man. What Wilson had achieved was to show what would happen if a geological process caused a fault, in which one body of rock breaks and slips alongside another, across a ridge that, for some reason, happened to be spreading open. He was interested because new bathymetric survey data, the sounding of the seas, was showing, to everyone's astonishment, that the great ridges that ran down the centres of both the Atlantic and the Pacific Oceans were incised by dozens of deep gashes. Geologists initially thought these gashes were spectacular versions of nothing more than classic faults, tearing the ridge asunder as they sheared to the left or the right as random happenstance directed. But Tuzo Wilson looked at the bathymetric pictures of these gashes again and said to himself, "No, if the ridge in the centre happened itself to be opening up for some wholly unconnected reason, then the directions of the fault slippage would be exactly the opposite of those that might happen across a line that was totally stable." He gave a name to the new phenomenon, whereas a normal left-to-right or right-to-left fault was known as a transcurrent fault. What he was now predicting, and which had never been seen or described before, because no one had ever imagined a ridge spreading itself open, he decided to call a transform fault. He drew diagrams of how this new invention should appear, how its oppositeness from normal should manifest itself. He created paper and crayon diagrams of the model and cut them out and kept them in his wallet, showing them to anyone who would give him the time of day. This friendly Canadian gentleman, scrupulously dressed, nicely mannered, with his cut-out papers in his pockets, soon became a familiar figure on more than a few university campuses in the early 1960s. And, just like John Dewey, everyone who saw Wilson's demonstration knew in an instant that he had it right there, the proof. All that was needed was a test, and for this the Cold War of blessed memory, at least blessed to many scientists, came promptly to the rescue. Just as the US Navy had been happy to tow magnetometers behind the Pioneer in the 50s, So in the 60s it was content to let scientists make use of a worldwide seismographic network it had deployed to listen for Soviet and Chinese nuclear weapons tests. It was a system with scores of highly sensitive pieces of seismic equipment deployed around the planet. It was ideally positioned to find out, in addition to the site of bomb detonations, something that it had been never designed to discern, the direction of slippage along some of the great fault line gashes in the mid-Pacific and the mid-Atlantic. The system worked its magic. The Pentagon agreed the result should be free from military classification that had so slowed earlier research. And so in 1967, from a laboratory at Columbia University that had examined the numbers, the results came tumbling out. The great faults in the middle of both oceans were indeed transform faults. Their slip directions were the exact opposite of what would be expected had they been standard transcurrent faults. Tuzo Wilson's ideas had been vindicated yet again, first with the evidence from the conveyor belt island chain of Hawaii, and now with his supposition about the world in general and what was going on in the unseen middle of its oceans. And of that there was now no doubt at all. The rocks underpinning the oceans were most assuredly splitting themselves apart. The academic battle that had been fought for the previous 50 years was now over for good. The stabilists, as were called those who believed, as most once had, that the world and its continents had always been in approximately the same place, had finally to yield. The day belonged to the mobilists, who had since Wegener's time argued that the continents wandered, and with what are now known to be dramatic and highly visible effects, such as the creation of the modern map of the world. It was, for science, an incredibly exciting time. An odd time, too, for geologists soon began to realise that they had been studying their Earth backwards. It was as though an entomologist had begun studying a bee by looking not at the bee as a whole, but at the microscopic structure of the yellow hairs on its abdomen, or if a botanist tried to get to know an oak tree by first using an electron microscope to peer at a cross-section of an acorn. It is all a function of man's own insignificant size compared to what he is studying, of course, but the fact is, and was realised when plate tectonics came along, geology had been spending its previous two millennia as a major science looking in great detail at sandstones and gneisses and rift valleys and ammonites, but had never been able to stand back and look at the planet as a whole and then work out the details, as happens with most sciences and where man is generally bigger than whatever it is he's studying. Plate tectonics offered for the first time an intellectual mechanism for taking the Earth and looking at it as an entity. And the fact that its emergence as a brand new science coincided so nicely with the development of satellites that could look at the planet as a whole was fortuitous, to say the least. One might say that all this meant that for the first time geologists were able to begin looking at things right side up. And what a vision was now laid out before them. The oceans were coming apart at the seams. The crust and the upper mantle beneath them were then spreading out across the deep ocean floors, moving in opposite directions on each flank of the mid-ocean ridges. Then, when the mobile material reached the edge of the ocean, the edge of the plate, to use Tuzo Wilson's now universally accepted term, so it plunged down below whatever it met, readying itself to be recycled in the deepest recesses of the planet, to return to the half-molten underneath of the world, and in due course to thrust itself up once more through the oceanic centres and begin the long circular process all over again. Plate tectonics is, in essence, the way by which the world deals with its steady loss of heat. A vast amount of heat was accumulated during the formation of the planet, a little over 4,500 million years ago. A natural radioactivity, particularly the decay of isotopes of potassium, uranium and thorium, served only to add to the ferocity of the internal fire. But that heat is now ebbing away, and the means by which it is transferred from the deep interior to the surface tends to be by way of convection currents, just like those one sees working in a vat of vegetable soup simmering on the range. The rate of movement of these convected currents is very, very small. It's generally to be measured in only millimetres each year. Currents of material of the inner Earth rise up from the red-hot region, maybe 1,000 miles down. They pass right through a swimmy, hot, weakly plastic region called the asthenosphere, and then, when they reach a region above this, anywhere from 4 to 20 miles below the surface, they slow, stop, and eventually, in classic convection current vegetable soup fashion, they turn back downwards once again. The currents, with the soft and pliable and plastic rocks of which they are composed, turn tail at this point on their upward journey because they encounter an inconveniently brittle and rigid layer of the earth, the upper part of the mantle and the entirety of the crust, which is today called the lithosphere, and it is in the lithosphere that the tectonic plates themselves exist. In the oceans, the lithosphere is thin, maybe 4 miles thick, and it is young, no more than 200 million years old. The lithosphere at the continents, with all their long-ago-made limestones and granites and shales and gabbros and schists and gneisses piled on top, can, on the other hand, be as much as 20 miles thick and much, much older, typically, in fact, as much as 2 billion years old. It's from these two kinds of lithosphere that the tectonic plates are made. The convection process that is going on below them, and which is slowly cooling the earth to its ultimate frigid darkness, is what drives them to move and shuffle and shunt and bang their way around the surface of the earth. It is a deeply complex subject, the stuff of mathematical modelling and the employment of banks of supercomputers. It's still far from being fully understood. But out of the early unravelling and understanding of the process was born in those early years yet another new term, a subduction zone. This, it seemed, was where the real business of the world was done. This was the comparatively narrow strip of territory below which, at the edges of the plates, the moving material collided, and one of the plates slipped beneath the other and began to head back downwards to balance the creation of the new lithospheric material at the oceanic seams. Most of the plates that converge do, in fact, display subduction, and so by finding out just where the world's subduction zones were, science could find the boundaries of most of the planet's tectonic plates, and by identifying them, work out what was happening to them, where, how fast, and why. Ever since the beginning of the 1970s, the phrase subduction zone appears to have been first used, once again in Nature, in the issue of the 14th of November 1970, a huge proportion of the world's geophysicists have been engaged in studying their bewildering complexities and their seminal influence on the arrangement of the Earth. What happens deep within their hot and roiling mysteries is crucial to the understanding of the processes of the Earth's making. All the greatest dramas of the solid world's evolution happen within them. And dramas that also include The Realization, which was published in an otherwise obscure book in 1980, that it is subduction along the Java Trench, where the Indo-Australian plate is moving under the Indonesian island chain that fueled the 1883 eruption of Krakatoa. The Earth's surface appears to be armoured with between 6 and 36 of these rigid plates, depending upon how they're defined and counted. Many of the boundaries between plates have been drawn on the basis only of educated guesswork. What happens deep in the interior of China, for instance, where one plate is thought to meet another, has not yet been fully explained, nor is it known what goes on around what is called the Scotia Arc in the Chile South Atlantic, east of the Falkland Islands. But generally speaking, modern tectonics accepts, subject to arguments about definition and counting, the undisputed existence of about one dozen major plates. The boundaries between these, and where the mechanics of the planet's architecture are best exhibited, are by now very well drawn. Exactly what happens at the boundaries depends on a number of factors. If the plate is entirely of oceanic material, that is, basically basalt, and if it collides more or less head-on with another plate of the same type, then there is almost a randomly decided subduction, with one plate indeed sliding beneath the other, and an arc-shaped arrangement of small volcanic islands is usually created, the arc being shaped according to the way that the plates move relative to one another. The chain of islands stretching along the international dateline south of Tonga, for example, is a classic illustration of what happens when two oceanic plates bump into one another. For the purposes of this story, they're best overlooked. If both plates are, on the other hand, composed mainly of continental material, which can best be thought of as a light scum of ancient granites and other sediments and metamorphic rocks lying on top of the oceanic basalts, then their collision may not result in a subduction at all. The continental material, being made up of lighter rocks, generally resists being thrust down into the Earth's subsurface, and both plates may stay instead on top, in line with one another, and may instead buckle and crumple, forming a chain of mountains that is in most places not volcanic at all. India and Asia are a pair of continental plates that are colliding, for example, with the effect that the Earth's crust, where they smash into one another, has crumpled itself up together and has more than doubled in thickness to form the world's highest mountains, the Himalayas. The Africa plate is similarly moving slowly northwards and is colliding with the Eurasian plate, the highly unstable mountains of the Caucasus, the earthquake-prone hills of Turkey, the ever-restless fracture zone of the Balkans, the ski slopes of Iran's Mount Damavand. All these are a consequence of this entirely continental plate collision. But where there's some small amount of subduction, as near Vesuvius and Etna, there are volcanoes. Shallow focus, very dangerous earthquakes are to be found everywhere along a continental collision zone. Volcanoes are much more likely only where there's subduction. It's also possible, given the complicated geometry of the Earth, the two plates may well not hit each other head-on, but may slide alongside one another like a tyre sliding past the curb during a lame attempt at parking. The world's best-known example of this kind of meeting is the San Andreas Fault in California, a fault notorious for what humankind regards as its capricious behaviour, but which a geologist would not think of as capricious at all, and which causes earthquakes in abundance, and which has enabled Hollywood to come up with some heroically awful films about volcanoes bursting out in Pasadena, tsunamis, lethally immense sea waves, scooping surfers off Pebble Beach, and faraway politicians uttering such memorably droll slogans as, "The coast is toast." The fault, the San Andreas Fault, is a classic example of what is known as a conservative plate boundary, where there's no collision, no crumpling, no subduction. The immense Pacific plate is here simply moving northwards relative to the North American plate, sliding along it at about half an inch a year. Extraordinary stresses can build up if this movement is somehow hindered by friction, for example. And when this stress becomes overwhelming and is suddenly released, terrible earthquakes can and do occur. During the infamous San Francisco earthquake of 1906, parts of the fault, which in recent years had accelerated its rate of sliding to almost 4 inches a year, shot past each other a total of 21 feet in a matter of 20 seconds. Finally, and most importantly for the understanding of what happened at Krakatoa, there are those events that occur when two plates of different types collide, when one plate that is all oceanic basalt smashes itself into another plate that is loaded up with continental crust. These, so far as this story is concerned, are the really important ones. What takes place when plates of different composition run into one another, as might be expected, but was actually not until that sudden realisation made in 1967, is that the heavier of the two, the oceanic plate, dips itself underneath the edge of the lighter, continent-laden plate. Immediately it started to do so, matters directly beneath the point of collision, matters within the classically formed subduction zone, that is, become complicated beyond belief, and to the geophysicist, endlessly fascinating. What takes place within the zone also has a profound effect on the making of the region above and on the lives of the human and animal inhabitants there, not least because, intermittently, the results of the plates meeting and the making of a subduction zone can be very dangerous indeed. In essence, the process at a subduction zone begins when the colliding oceanic plate begins to head off down back into the Earth. It drags some of the continental plate down with it, and in doing so it causes a pinch, a trench in the bed of the sea. In the case of Java, the 5-mile-deep Java Trench, 200 miles off the coast, provides vivid evidence of the plate as it begins barreling its way downward. Behind it, with the coral reefs of Cocos Keeling Island, Christmas Island, the flat blue Indian Ocean, and in the far distance the coast of Australia, all is placid, paradisal, serene. Ahead of the down-racing plate is the trench, a line of offshore islands, and then Java and Sumatra, one of the most volcanically unstable pairs of islands ever known. They're unstable because of a well-understood, if wonderfully complicated, mechanism. The down-racing plate heads into the heat, dragging with it billions upon billions of tons of additional material, and most crucially of all, water. This it gets from the huge thickness of waterlogged sediments that are being dragged down from the seabed. Once this waterlogged material is stirred into the mix and reaches a critical depth, so, quite unexpectedly to those who first noted the phenomenon, it begins to melt, doing so because the addition of this water has lowered the melting temperature of the mix. And so, what starts off beneath the seas as cold and solid now moves down towards the hot mantle, turns viscous and runny, and its fluid components begin to sweat out, suddenly bubbling and frothing and coursing, and, because they are light and volatile, so rising back up again, passing into the solid mantle through which all their downsliding ingredients had passed. To make matters more complicated still, as they course upwards through this material, so they begin melting that too. Suddenly, a Hadean nightmare is being created miles beneath the subducted continental crust. Immense volumes of boiling, gaseous, white-hot magma, alive with bubbles and energy and restless muscle, seethe in vaults and chambers of unimaginable size and temperature. The Promethean material searches ceaselessly, hunting for some weakened spot in the crust above it. Every so often it finds one, a crack or a crevice or a fault, and then it forces its way up into a holding chamber, and before long, once the accumulating pressure of the uprushing material becomes just too great, and the temperature becomes too high, and the proportion of dissolved gases becomes too great, then it explodes out into the open air in a vicious cannonade of destruction. A type of volcano which, because of its position at the edge of a subduction zone, is far more explosive and dangerous than any other of the world's many different kinds of volcano, suddenly, and if there are people around, invariably terrifyingly, erupts. 2 points of simple geography remain. The first is a matter of tectonic trivia. The Indo-Australian plate, which is the culprit in creating all of the volcanic tamasha so notoriously present on Java, on Sumatra, and on the tiny island that once lay between them in the Sunda Strait, is moving because the seafloor south of Australia is spreading open. It's possible to calculate both the speed of that opening and the pole of rotation around which this spreading is taking place. The speed of the seafloor spreading, the rate at which the Indo-Australian plate is moving northwards and colliding with the Eurasian plate, seems to be about 4 inches a year, 100 yards every millennium. Put another way, when Java man, the Homo erectus who first came to these parts from Africa, was living in central Java about 1.7 million years ago, Australia and Asia were rather more than 100 miles further apart than they are today. They've been moving towards each other ever since, and doing so in a direction that, unusual though it may seem, turns around a pole of rotation that is located a few miles to the south and east of the Egyptian capital, Cairo. And secondly, though imperfect at best, and complex in the extreme as more and more details become known, there is one delightful symmetry that's noticeable. In plotting the tracks of the subduction zones that enfold the islands of Indonesia and which create all the trenches and the island arcs and the volcanoes and all the mayhem that goes on among the islands of the archipelago, this modern and quite visible line of geology more or less follows the invisible line of biology and botany that was first hinted at by Philip Sclater in 1857 and drawn on a map a year later by Alfred Russel Wallace. On one side, Australia, cassowaries, emus, kangaroos. On the other, cows, monkeys, thrushes and elephants. On one side, the Indo-Australian plate. On the other, the Eurasian plate. In the middle, where the two plates meet and where they come together so very slowly, but with such an immense and unthinkable deployment of raw power, is in consequence a serried line of the world's greatest and most dangerous and predictably unpredictable volcanoes, including, lurking just on the Asian side of an imagined extrapolation of the Wallace line, the most demonstrably dangerous of them all, the once great island of Krakatoa, an island which has exploded many more times than on the one occasion for which it is now so notorious. Chapter 4. the moments when the mountain moved. During the 20 or 30,000 years that have been recorded by the cave paintings or songs, the memories or the carvings or the writings of man, the small cluster of volcanoes and off-islands that for the last 300 years we have come to call collectively Krakatoa has exploded either once, twice, 4 or even 11 times, depending on just how the runes of geology, myth and circumstance are read and interpreted. 4 of these eruptions are generally accepted to have emerged from the mists of uncertain history into the realms of possible reality. And yet of these 4, 1 is widely thought of now as most unlikely to have occurred at all, the date of a 2nd is very reluctantly agreed to, a 3rd is known to have been very poorly reported and subject to wanton hyperbole, and only the most recent truly survives as the one of the 4 that is incontrovertibly regarded as having taken place. There is some evidence that a very long while before that, perhaps 60,000 years ago or more, there once was a very much larger mountain which some geologists like to call ancient Krakatoa, and which they believe was something like 6,000 feet high and was centred on an almost perfectly circular island about 9 miles in diameter. But then a gigantic eruption, witnessed only by gibbering hominids and Neanderthals, if indeed by anyone, may have devastated the island and its peak, blowing almost all to smithereens. Once the dust had settled, what remained of ancient Krakatoa was a group of 4 quite small and apparently stable-looking islands. At the northern end of the group were 2 low and crescent-shaped skerries, one to the east called Panjang, about 3 miles long, and to the west its larger colleague, 4 miles long, called Sertung. Embraced within the parenthesis created by these twins was both a tiny chunk of the fine-grained volcanic rock known as andesite and called Polish Hat, and the northern end of the island that we truly once regarded as Krakatoa proper. This was then a lozenge-shaped mass, 6 miles long by 2 wide and 0.5 mile high at its higher southern end. The southern summit was called Rakata. To its north were 2 smaller crater peaks. The first, roughly in the island's centre, was called Danan, and, nudging up into the sky from the island's narrower northern spur, was a 2nd, known as Per Buatan. This main island was found by early visitors to be always well forested. It had an abundance of fresh-looking lava flows and steaming hot springs, and outcrops of sulphur, which were once worked by Batavian dynamite makers. Over the century, it had been used variously as a VOC naval reconnaissance station, as a place to build small ships, as a base for a small northern Sunda Strait fishing fleet, and in 1809, and for the decade following, as a remote and barely accessible Alcatraz for those recalcitrant native prisoners whom the Dutch could not control on the mainland. Some few have suggested that it was an island of evil reputation, a lair for pirates, a place where those visitors from Java and Sumatra who might sail over in their prahus to collect wood or wild fruit were sufficiently disenchanted as to omit to leave offerings for Krakatoa's local gods. In fact, there's little evidence of this, however seductive the symbolism and the symmetry, the island of vile repute that exploded and killed thousands. From most credible accounts, Krakatoa's real reputation was actually rather the reverse. For by the reports of most Western visitors, there were from time to time a number of contented, if somewhat impoverished, little settlements on the island. The great English circumnavigating explorer Captain James Cook, for example, stopped on the main island of Krakatoa twice. In January 1771, his colleague Joseph Banks, the renowned botanist and polymath, noted, "At night, anchored under a high island called in the draughts Krakatoa and by the Indian Pulo Rakata. This morn, when we rose, we saw that there were many houses and much cultivation upon Krakatoa, so that probably a ship might meet with refreshments who chose to touch here." 6 years later, when Cook called in again, he still found a village and fields of cultivation. Pepper was being grown and harvested, as well as other cash crops. 3 years later still, the Resolution and the Discovery stopped at Krakatoa one further time. But on this occasion, in February 1780, they were without James Cook himself, since he had been bludgeoned to death in Hawaii the previous November. The ships stopped in the crescent-shaped roads between Krakatoa and Panjang Island for 5 days, giving the fleet artist, John Webber, time to make elaborate drawings of the village houses and the luxuriant vegetation, palms, tall grasses, ferns, in the valley on Krakatoa, between the two more southerly peaks of Danan and Rakata. The expedition's daybook recorded the details of the party's sojourn on the island. The Resolution refilled its barrels at a stream located at the southern extremity of the little island, a short distance from the shoreline. A little to the south, one finds a heat source where the islanders bathe. While we were on a level with the southern extremity of this island, the master went to find an aiguad, but he disembarked with difficulty and returned without finding any sweet water. The island of Krakatoa is considered very healthy in comparison to those thereabouts. She offers elevated ground, which rises little by little from the shoreline on all sides. She is covered with trees, except in several places where the islanders have cleared them for growing rice. The population is not very considerable. The chief is subject to the king of Bantam, just as those of the other islands in the strait. One finds on the coral reef a large quantity of little turtles, refreshments which elsewhere are very rare and have an enormous price. The pepper groves had all but disappeared 10 years later when the Dutch administrator visited. Such people as lived on Krakatoa then were raising chickens and goats and made small sums selling firewood, water and food to stopping ships. There may have been people living on the island at the time of each of the early eruptions. At the time of the cataclysm, Krakatoa was quite wisely vacant, but there's no suggestion that it had an evil name. The three early occasions that, according to most modern history books, possibly saw eruptions were, according to the Western calendar, only lately adopted in Java, the Anno Domini years 416, 535 and 1680. There's the vaguest of suggestions that between the 9th and the 16th century there were also no fewer than 7 additional eruptive episodes, and that during the single century when the Buddhist kings of the Kailendra dynasty were on the throne in central Java, Krakatoa became so notoriously active that it was called the Fire Mountain. This figure of 7, when added to the 3 possible eruptions and the single certain catastrophe, gives the tally of 11, a number which is rather doubtful, it must be said. The one subsequent occasion when Krakatoa went wild is the only year that is fixed with total certainty, and that is 1883. Of the 3 earlier occasions, I'm afraid I'm going to dismiss the Kailendra 7 for want of any evidence at all, other than the somewhat less than illuminating Fire Mountain remark in a Buddhist manuscript. We are rather less sure just when or what took place, if indeed anything did. For completeness' sake, though, it is probably worth first exploring something of the shadowy world of old Java, to see if it's possible to establish with any certainty the early volcanic history of the island, if for no other reason than that the establishment of Krakatoa's eruptive past may offer us some useful clue as to her probable future.